in the next hour on Morning Ireland. Must do better. Here's a bonus. We'll talk to Junior Minister Damien English about the latest on Irish water and a multi-million euro government investment into science research, shooting and expelling sex offenders but ultimately failing victims. Sinn Féin TD Desi Ellis on how the IRA policed and punished sex abuse. Also, overruling the Pope, saving sons and daughters in the northeast, and in sport, a Euro rugby kickoff and a county final roundup.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 20th of October, and you're listening to Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English.
The headlines: Gardaí are warning of traffic disruption at Dublin Port this morning because of a protest by hundreds of hauliers over road taxes. EU foreign ministers are meeting in Luxembourg to discuss a more coordinated approach to the Ebola crisis. And the North's First Minister, Peter Robinson, is to meet Maria Cahill, the Belfast woman who says she was raped by a member of the IRA and subsequently interrogated by senior members of the organisation. Brian Jennings has the news in full.
Gardaí are warning of traffic disruption at Dublin Port this morning because of a protest by hauliers over higher road tax for lorries here compared to the UK. Trucks are being prevented from exiting the port and the North Wall Quay roundabout is blocked. Diane Connor reports.
Shortly after 5 this morning, truck drivers started a blockade around Dublin Port. It's part of a campaign calling on the government to change the system of road tax for commercial vehicles before the budget is passed into law. At the moment, it costs €4,000 to tax every six-axle truck here, compared to £640 in the north. The hauliers are also protesting over a tax of £10 on every truck entering the UK. The Irish Road Hauliers Association says 50,000 people are employed in the haulage sector, and if things do not change, these jobs will be at risk. They say they will continue their protest until around 10 this morning, causing traffic delays for motorists. Gardaí have warned of delays affecting inbound traffic approaching the city centre from the M1 and M50, and are advising motorists to find alternative routes. Diane Connor, RTÉ News at Dublin Port.
European Union foreign ministers are gathering in Luxembourg this morning for a meeting that will be dominated by the global health scare caused by the Ebola virus. Foreign ministers are expected to push for a more coordinated approach to Ebola at European level, so that more health workers from member states can be encouraged to travel to West Africa to join the effort in containing the spread of the virus. From Luxembourg, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
The World Health Organization reckons that by December there will be up to 10,000 new cases of Ebola per week, with up to 70% of victims dying. While recriminations continue about the world's slow response to the epidemic, the emphasis now is on how to contain the virus at source, namely in the West African countries of Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea. That means flooding the region with qualified health workers, providing thousands of beds and isolation expertise, and trying to change the behaviour of communities caught up in the epidemic. There is a consensus that Europe and America are best equipped to respond to these needs. While the UK, France and Germany have been taking the lead in providing beds, funding and aircraft, it's felt that more needs to be done to reassure European doctors and nurses contemplating a frontline mission that they will receive any medical attention needed, either in the field or through a medical evacuation. The problem is that the more health workers who attend to the source of the outbreak, the more medical evacuation capacity is required. Tony Connolly, RTÉ News, Luxembourg.
Meanwhile, further tests are to be carried out on a Spanish nurse who contracted Ebola to confirm she is completely free of the virus. A Spanish government statement said tests on Teresa Romero, who was the first person to contract Ebola outside West Africa, were negative yesterday. She became ill after caring for two infected priests in a Madrid hospital. It comes as the World Health Organization is expected to declare Nigeria free of Ebola later today. The outbreak there has been limited to 8 deaths from 20 cases since July. Northern Ireland's First Minister Peter Robinson is to meet Maria Cahill at Stormont today. Ms Cahill claims she was raped by a member of the IRA in 1997 when she was a teenager and was later interrogated by the IRA about her accusations. Last night, the Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams said that the IRA acted as a police force in many nationalist areas during the Troubles, and was ill-equipped to deal with allegations of sexual abuse. In an article published on his blog, Mr. Adams outlined how Republicans dealt with allegations of child abuse, saying that the IRA on occasion shot alleged sex offenders or expelled them. US military aircraft have dropped weapons, ammunition and medical supplies to Kurdish fighters battling Islamic State militants in the key Syrian town of Kobani. Previous US airstrikes have helped to push back IS militants intent on taking control of the town, which lies near the border with Turkey. The move is likely to anger America's ally Turkey, which has fought a decades-long insurgency by the Kurdish militant group PKK. The supplies dropped by American planes were provided by Kurdish authorities in Iraq. A two-year-old girl is being treated in hospital after a suspected assault in County Armagh. The alleged attack happened in Bessbrook yesterday evening. A man in his 20s has been arrested and has been questioned about the assault. A 38-year-old man has been killed in a road crash in Dublin city centre. He died when his motorbike collided with a bus outside the Broadstone bus depot at Constitution Hill just before midnight last night. The government has announced details of five new world-class scientific research centres in which €245 million of state and industry funding is to be invested. The six-year investment will directly support the jobs of 700 existing and new researchers. Our science and technology correspondent, Will Goodbody.
The centres which are being announced under the Science Foundation Ireland Research Centres programme span a variety of areas of science considered critical and emerging sectors of the economy. ADAPT's focus will be on connecting people digitally. Connect will research computer and telecom networks. Curum will be all about medical devices of the future. iCrag will aim to discover and harness new raw materials and energy resources, while Liro is a software research centre. Two of the centres will be led by Trinity College Dublin, with NUI Galway, UCD and University of Limerick all leading one each. But in total, 14 academic institutions across the country will be involved in running the five centres. €155 million of the funding will be invested by the Exchequer, with the €90 million balance coming in cash and in-kind contributions from 165 industry partners like Google, Microsoft, Tullow Oil and FBD. The announcements, to be made formally later today by Jobs Minister Richard Bruton, will bring to 12 the number of world-class centres established by SFI.
Now the time is coming up to 8 minutes past eight.
Caroline Murphy is here with It Says in the Papers.
Well, it's a case of water, water everywhere this morning as the papers pick up on RTE's This Week story yesterday about Irish Water's bonus system. While the news that Irish Water has defended its bonus payment scheme makes only the second story on the front of the Irish Times, most of the other papers lead with it. Irish Water's €9,000 bonus for staff who need improvement is the Irish Independent headline. Bonuses for water staff lambasted, says the Irish Examiner, while outrage as Irish Waters pays bonus for failure, declares the Irish Daily Mail. In The Independent, John Downing writes that the mood within both Fine Gael and Labour is increasingly angry, as TDs believe serious public relations disasters at Irish Water could cost them the next election. In The Mail, Niamh Lyons says the government is coming under massive pressure to find a way to cancel the bonus payments in the forthcoming finance bill, while in The Examiner, Sean Connolly says Fianna Fáil have accused the government of trying to scapegoat Irish Water's John Tierney. Irish Rugby's Brian O'Driscoll gets a lot of attention meanwhile this morning as well. Following up the publication of extracts from his autobiography, the Irish Sun picks up on his experience of the American justice system. "Bod My Terror in Hellhole Jail" is the headline there, while The Independent puts his picture on page one and follows up with a spread over pages two and three, looking at how he described his dark days and the death of his friend Barry Toomey. On the evidence of yesterday's extract, says Vincent Hogan, O'Driscoll understood the need to peel back a few layers of the public persona and reveal some of what lies beneath. Revealing some of what lies beneath in the IRA, meanwhile, Gerry Adams. The lead story in The Times is on what he posted on his blog. We're told Gerry Adams said last night abuse victims were failed by the IRA policy of shooting alleged sex offenders, and that his admission came as Enda Kenny and Peter Robinson prepare to meet Maria Cahill. The paper reports Mr. Adams saying IRA members were singularly ill-equipped to deal with such matters. Matters to do with a former senior IRA member, meanwhile, make the front of the Irish Daily Mirror. That paper leads with a claim, which it says is being made about the late Joe Cahill, former chief of staff of the organisation, that pictures of him were used to blackmail him into spying for authorities. The authority of the IRA itself, meanwhile, is the subject of a piece on page 2 in the Times, writing about Maria Cahill while also recalling the heroic sisters of the murdered Robert McCartney. Mary Minahan says it wouldn't be the first time republicanism has been derailed by mistreated women. The chances of patients being mistreated, or rather inappropriately treated, because of IT issues at Cork University Hospital, meanwhile, make the front page in the Examiner. Hospital IT issues heighten the risk of misdiagnosis is the headline. Catherine Shanahan says the problem of database corruption and its potential effect on pathology results and consequently patient treatment is flagged in the risk register in 2012, 2013 and 2014. The 2014 rise in property prices, meanwhile, make the front of the Independent. Rural prices now rising faster than capital is the headline. Mark Keenan says counties which have not seen any growth since the boom are now experiencing a sharp rise in prices for three-bed semis, and also that some rural areas recorded gains of up to 30% in 2014. Otherwise, this morning, the Irish Daily Star leads with the very sad death of a teenage boxer in Cork after a chip pan fire, while the picture on the front of the Times marks the memorial service yesterday for Ian Paisley. In features, the Examiner has a special report on the new policing authority. The rush to establish it has left important questions about how it will work go unanswered, says Cormac McKeefe. While in the Times, Conor Pope looks at what he says has been a shaky first year for the insolvency service. Those who aren't insolvent, meanwhile, are spending big on weddings, according to a feature in The Independent. The big fat wedding is back, we're told. But finally, from the wedding to the babies, another piece in The Independent brings the news that if men want to have children, they should drink beer and not coffee. It's been discovered, we're told, that caffeine may harm sperm at a molecular level, but moderate amounts of alcohol reduce stress levels and may help conception.
Thank you, Caroline.
At 16 minutes past 8, the Sinn Féin president, Gerry Adams, has acknowledged that the IRA did investigate allegations of sex abuse and, on occasion, shot or expelled alleged sex offenders. In a lengthy statement issued last night, he said that the IRA ultimately failed victims of sex offenders, but continued to refute allegations made by Belfast woman Maria Cahill, who last week said she was raped by a senior member of the IRA and interrogated by the IRA in the late 1990s. Gerry Adams isn't available to us this morning. Sinn Féin TD Desi Ellis spoke to us earlier, first on his understanding of how the IRA investigated claims of sex abuse.
No, but I'm just saying what I said was that the IRA did carry out, if any member was accused of anything, and it was across the board, that they would deal with that internally. They would investigate it, and that's what I said. I didn't specifically mention anything to do with child abuse, but that is a well-known fact, you know.
So if it was alleged against a member of the IRA or a Republican that they had raped or abused somebody, how would that have been investigated?
Well, I wasn't in part, so I wouldn't know. But all I would say is that if there was an allegation made against any member of the IRA, it would be investigated.
How?
And there would be a team set up to investigate it. And that team would be chosen by Republicans that would have a good standing.
And how would they do that investigation?
Well, I honestly don't know, because I wouldn't have been involved in it, you know.
Gerry Adams is quoted on his blog last night as saying, "Despite the high standards and decency of the vast majority of IRA volunteers, IRA personnel were singularly ill-equipped to deal with these matters." And he's referring to child abuse and to rape. The IRA on occasion shot alleged sex offenders or expelled them. While this may have been expedient at the time, it was not appropriate. Did you know they were doing that at the time?
Well, I didn't know any specific case, but I just knew that if there was an allegation made against anyone, it would be investigated. And if If a person was found guilty, then it may be dealt with, but depending on the seriousness of it, it would be dealt in a certain way.
He also went on to say, but these actions were of their time and reflected not only a community at war, but also an attitude within Ireland which did not then understand or know, as we now do, how deeply embedded abuse is in our society. He's acknowledging, therefore, that the Republican movement didn't handle child abuse and rape very well.
Well, I don't think anyone would have been equipped to deal with that issue. In you know, I think it requires certain skills, certain training, and this should be left up to the people that specialise in those areas of investigation. And I think that's, I think it goes without saying, because you have to remember there would have been tens of thousands of Republicans that came through prison or that were involved in the struggle. For well over 30 years. So you had a situation that the police were not acceptable. The areas across the board had to be policed in some manner, and unfortunately the IRA had the role in policing.
An attitude within Ireland which did not then understand or know, as we now do, how deeply embedded abuse is in our society. That sounds very reminiscent of the kind of language that the Catholic Church used to explain why they covered up and moved on abusers themselves.
Well, I don't believe for one minute anything was covered up, and I don't believe there was any sort of circle or otherwise that was covering up these things. I think, I think there was mechanisms found in terms of dealing with that and passing on the information through other sources to go to the police or to go to someone else to deal with this.
Shooting or expelling them?
Well, I mean, that's something I'm not aware of, and the extent of that. But all I'm saying is that there would have been some mechanism found to deal with a situation if a person was found guilty.
Last week, when Maria Cahill made her claims through Spotlight that the IRA had investigated allegations of abuse themselves internally, several members of Sinn Féin denied that this had happened. Is Maria Cahill now vindicated?
No, well, I made it clear, when I said myself, you know, that there was investigations, and if an allegation was made against someone, there would have been an investigation. And if in Maria Cahill's case there was an allegation, it would have been investigated.
But several members of your own party, including Piers Doherty, when asked if the IRA and Sinn Féin had dealt internally with cases of abuse, had said no, that was unfounded and untrue, to quote him.
Well, I'd say that they probably didn't know, and likewise, I wouldn't know about cases being investigated. I just think that that's the case, that a lot of people wouldn't have known.
Do you accept, therefore, that Maria Cahill's contention that the Republican movement internally dealt with these abuse allegations is now true?
Well, I can't speak on any specific case because I'm not sure myself, but if she made an allegation, and with her family connections, Joe Cahill was a senior Republican and she was related to him, I'd assume that if an allegation was made, it would have been investigated, but I don't know specifically myself.
But as I said, she had claimed that she was interrogated by the Republican movement, interrogated by the IRA over abuse allegations, and Gerry Adams and other members of your party had said that that's not how the party dealt with abuse allegations. Is she now vindicated?
And I'm not, as I said, I don't know. I don't know specifically in her case what the procedure was. All I can say is that if an allegation was made, it would have been investigated and people would have been interviewed.
Is she owed an apology?
Well, I think anyone that went through any trauma as a result of what is a perceived investigation, I think, it was wrong and it should never have happened.
The story on the front page of the Daily Mirror this morning: British spies recruited pedo IRA chief, and this refers to Joe Cahill, the granduncle of Maria Cahill. What do you make of it?
I just don't listen to nonsense, because I don't believe Joe Cahill for one minute was a very senior Republican and a great Republican, so I just wouldn't listen to nonsense.
What do you make of the timing of it?
Well, I think the timing and everything is when the Republican movement has been seen to be doing well, riding high in the polls, then you see all these attacks on the Republican movement, and I don't think it's any coincidence.
Sinn Féin TD Desi Ellis.
Details of five new scientific research centres will be announced today. €245 million in state and industry funding will be invested over 6 years. The Minister of State with responsibility for skills, research and innovation, Damien English, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. How are things?
Not so bad at all, thank you. Will you give us an idea of what it is that these centres will do?
Yeah, basically, the Science Foundation Ireland, which was kind of channeled investment from the government in this area, they're trying to focus the money into five key research centres, which will build up expertise in areas of importance to Ireland and areas where we think we'll do well. The centres will be based around the country, channeling taxpayers' money, along with money from industry as well. So in total, there's 245 million. It'll employ directly 700 researchers, along with a lot more as well. So what they're doing here is they're going to focus on developing products, processes and commercialisation of research in this area that will lead on to jobs, will lead on to innovative ideas in the medical devices sector, in networks and telecommunications and areas like that, which will lead on to, you know, hopefully new companies being spun out and new research that will be used by our larger companies, multinationals, which will create jobs and win market share of products in the future as well.
But in the short term, how many jobs will actually be created, or is this about shoring up jobs that are already there?
This is building on the capacity that's been generated over the last 10 years in this country. We've been doing very well to build up our basic research. Now we want to apply that research to turn out jobs and to lead to commercialisation. It will, you know, over the years we probably had a lot of small research centres in Ireland, but now we're trying to go for large areas that have impact. There were seven picked in 2013. This is five more now, and it's to channel the money to maximise the benefit in relation to industry money as well as taxpayer money, channel to all the research institutions, to bring in the top guys from all over the country and probably all over the world as well, to focus on areas where Ireland can excel. So we've no doubt this will lead on to jobs. There's absolutely no doubt about that. It's quite, you know, it's improving and it will work.
As you say, industry will be providing a sizeable part of the funding, €90 million of the total. Does this mean that these companies, Google, Microsoft, Tullow Oil and others, that they'll have a sizeable say in the process as well?
Well, I mean, everything's worked out together. You're right, about 70% of the money will be taxpayers' money coming through all the various institutions, and about 30% of their money. So they'll have a fair stake. But the whole idea here is to build collaboration, is to have industry and our research community working together and, you know, putting the best brains of the best money together to get the best results. So it's worked quite well in the past. We've had a number of these centres already, and they're telling us great results and has led on to jobs as well. We know that a lot of companies too said okay to Ireland because of our capacity we built up in the research area, and our reputation has been built up. So people recognise the talent that's in Ireland. Okay. And our aim now is to focus that talent to make sure it builds for the future. And you're right, it's to give us the capacity to be able to grow our companies and our startups for the future as
well. All right. As you're with us, the subject that everybody has been talking about over the past couple of weeks, including those within Fine Gael, Irish Water, can it be right that employees whose performance is deemed to be in need of improvement, that they can get bonuses?
Well, first of all, we have to get the full picture of this. I mean, what's been reported is the bonus structure that's in Bord Gáis. We always knew that Irish Water would probably be ran along the same line as Bord Gáis, but we have to get the full details here to see exactly what's in question. I think
did we not get the full details yesterday? I mean, our colleague here in RT, John Burke, he had the full list of people's entitlements.
Well, my understanding is that no bonus has been paid out at all yet, or committed to.
But that's because it's a new company. It doesn't mean that bonuses won't be paid out in the near future.
Yeah, but the structure we've seen yesterday is in relation to the Bord Gáis structure. We haven't seen the structure for Irish Water. The concern here is does this add to the cost, and it certainly should not.
But this is the Irish Water structure. It was confirmed surely by the company in a statement. It's just the same as the Bord Gáis structure.
Yeah, they're saying that it's built into their payment plan is a kind of a bonus system, which they, as a commercial entity, they hope that it will drive productivity. We have to make sure that this does have achieve the three aims here, which is, you know, to improve the quality of water, to fix all the leaks on the pipes and so on, to have a water supply that can feed into an economy of Ireland, and not like the situation in Dublin where you only have one day supply of water at any given time. So there's three targets here for Irish Water to achieve, and number, you know, and we have to make sure that they can achieve that. But they have a structure built in, which probably involves some sort of payment structure or pay-related pay or bonus-related pay. We have to see, is that right? The regulator here sets the price to the consumer, so I don't believe this will impact on the cost to anybody paying for the water, and we have to make sure it's not. But like,
And what's your own view then? I mean, can it be right that an individual employee whose performance is deemed to be in need of improvement, that that employee can get a bonus?
Well, in my view, no one's earned a bonus yet in this situation, because there's a lot of misinformation about Irish Water, there's a lot of confusion out there, and we have to sort all that out, and people have to know exactly what they're going to get.
When you say misinformation, what do you mean?
Well, people out there are still slightly confused over how the thing works. So there's an information gap, and that is the job of Irish Water to fill that gap and to provide the information people know. Look, there's always going to be a certain percentage who never want to pay. There's then a high percentage who find it very difficult to pay and very hard. But everybody needs to know exactly what they're paying for, what the allowance for, and how it affects them. And there's some, you know, in relation to last week, we had landlords with some misinformation there. So there has to be clarity here. Everybody has to know exactly what they're going to get and what it's going to cost.
All right, just to be clear on it then, are you saying that you don't have any particular problem with this bonus structure?
Of course I would have a problem if bonuses are paid out wrongly or willingly to people who aren't doing a good job. But if there's a payment plan put in place that seems to have worked in board gosh, that will drive productivity, which will drive our aims here, which is to achieve a top quality water system. If it achieves that at no extra cost or necessary cost to the consumer, then that's okay with me. But that's why I said I want to see the full story here, because we don't want a bonus structure that just gives money away and ends up costing the consumer a lot more money for the water. That's not acceptable. But a bonus structure that drives productivity, that drives solutions, that does give value for money and does give the results to the consumer, which is the taxpayer who is using the water, then that's acceptable. But that's what I want to check. Okay. I want to make sure that it is an acceptable procedure.
Just one final question then in relation to Irish Water. It was reported in a number of the papers yesterday that senior coalition figures have discussed the need to replace the chief executive of the company and indeed the company's board. Should there be change at the top, do you think?
Well, my understanding is there's going to be changes in November, because the board's time was up in July and it's got an extension now until November. So there is going to be structural changes. I'm not close enough to that in that department to see exactly what those changes are going to be. But I think we have a system here which is going to change. So we will see how that pans out over the next couple of weeks.
All right, Damien English, thanks indeed for joining us. That was the Minister of State with responsibility for skills, research and innovation at 29 minutes to 9.
8:36, you're listening to Morning Ireland. Darren's back with more sports news. Morning again, Darren.
Good morning to you, Gavin. We'll start with the rugby. Leinster made a winning start to the Champions Cup. They had a 25-20 win against Wasps. The Irish province were down by 12 points at one stage in the first half, but they fought back to win by 5 points. Dara Fanning scored 2 tries, while Dominic Ryan touched down for the third. Ian Madigan kicked 2 penalties and 2 conversions. Matt O'Connor is the Leinster coach.
No, it was tough. You know, we knew it would be tough. We spoke all week about the threat that Wasps had, and they took those threats in the first half, and we gave them 14 soft points, which made it a bit of a mountain to climb. But down the hill at home, it wasn't ever too stressful, but a good result.
That score just before half time was pretty crucial, wasn't it?
Massive. Yeah, we had to get something. 20-8 is a big climb. 11, it's doable, and you know, the first score after half time was important.
Ah, that's Matt O'Connor speaking to Michael Corcoran. I'm joined on the line by Shane Byrne. Shane, how nervous were you during that 80 minutes at the RDS?
Absolutely. The game kind of slipped from one side to the other. They fought so hard to get in control of the game again, and then gave away that vital intercept try, which really threw them back in and made it a large hill to climb. But the only thing that was good about the game, definitely, was that Leinster responded every time. When they needed the score, they did, as Matt O'Connor said himself, and that is one positive to build from.
Now, no bonus point for Leinster at home against Wasps. Are you concerned by that?
Well, look, you can't. It is going to be so, so important, the bonus points, particularly the way all the groups are. And travelling away from home as Wasps were and getting the bonus point is something that is kind of going to be very, very important for Wasps. Matt O'Connor won't be too disappointed with not getting the the extra bonus point, but a win is a win. As long as you keep ticking those boxes, that's the thing he's going to be after more so.
I want to get your thoughts on the rest of the rugby action in a moment, yeah. Shane, but first let's listen back to one of the moments of the weekend. It came as Munster overcame Sale 27 points to 26.
Casey around Ostrakov to Russian inside the 22 metre line, back to Keatley, the attempted drop a goal, Keatley towards the post, Keatley with the drop a goal, it's gone between the posts. The referee has blown the full time whistle. Sale have been beaten.
Well, new competition, same old monster, Shane.
No doubt about it. If you changed all the names and you had Ron Nagar, Anthony Foley, Quinlan in there, you would have said absolutely classic Munster, well controlled. But they did it. You got a hand as Anthony Foley now coaching. It was the first time you saw a real classic Munster. They started off brilliantly. The game went away from them. Sale played some superb rugby, but typical Munster. They just such patience on the ball. Keatley only needed the opportunity. Fantastic.
And the jury might be out on this Munster team, but what are your hopes for them in the future this season?
Well, look, we've all seen them win games against the odds. And look, yes, it's not the best side they've ever had, no doubt about that. But as long as they can sew up, there was a huge gap in midfield, if they can sew up that problem and play with that confidence, you just never know.
Ulster beaten at the weekend by Leicester, 25 points to 18. They're playing catch-up, but do you fancy them to get back into this pool?
I think they will. I think they'd be very annoyed with what they let happen at the weekend. They, again, so many of their own errors handed easy points to Leicester, but they fought back brilliantly in the second half, but just too little too late. The bonus point again that they got away from home, I think, will be absolutely vital in that very, very difficult group.
And finally, Connacht, will they build on their victory over La Rochelle on Saturday?
That was fantastic. By half time, they had already secured the bonus point. La Rochelle are no pushover, but you know, a new into these European competitions. But Connacht were absolutely clinical, and everybody they need to stand up did stand up. Fantastic result.
Okay, great talking to you. Thanks for that. That's Shane Byrne joining us to review the rugby action at the weekend. Let's turn our attention now to the soccer. And Liverpool are up to fifth in the Premier League standings. They had a 3-2 win away to QPR. Richard Dunn handed Liverpool the lead in the 67th minute. His 10th own goal of his career. The other four goals came in a dramatic 8 minutes. A second own goal deep in injury time by Stephen Corker sealed the win for the visitors. Now Brendan Rodgers, the Liverpool manager, felt his side were lucky to win, and Harry Redknapp, the manager of QPR, has played down reports his future is now uncertain.
It's all rubbish. You can only do what you can do with what you got, you know, and no disrespect, but 7 or 8 of that team that started today played in the Championship last year when we finished 4th from top, you know. But I still feel we're going to be okay. I'm really positive.
Yeah, he's remaining a positive and very unlucky yesterday. Another Irish player, Jonathan Walters, got the winner in the 76th minute to give Stoke a 2-1 win against Swansea. Interesting story coming from Sunderland. Their goalkeeper, Victor Minoni, has said that he and his teammates should reimburse the fans who travelled to their 8-0 defeat away to Southampton at the weekend. Their defeat, the biggest margin of loss for the club in 32 years, and the goalkeeper wants to meet the cost of the 700-mile journey made by the 2,500 supporters.
Yeah, they were hammered. You mentioned John Waters and Richard Dunn being on the score sheets for different reasons over the weekend. Shane Long, Ireland centre forward, not among the 8 goals that Southampton banged in against Sunderland over the weekend.
Just as well they didn't need him with that very generous defending by the Sunderland defence, Gavin. In Gaelic games, a very busy weekend on the club front. In football, a late goal from Desi Moan saw Monaghan champions Clontibert beat Kilcoo of Down 1-9 to 11 points in Ulster. Ballintubber overcame Castlebar Mitchells by a goal in the Mayo decider. Currafin and Cross McGlen defended their county championship crowns in Galway and Armagh. Schlock Nail beat Ballinderry in the Derry football final. St. Gall's are the Antrim champions again. St. Bridget's made it 5 Roscommon titles in a row. In Meath, Navan O'Mahony's overcame Dunamore Ashburn by 2 points. In Kildare, Sarsfields and Moorfield will meet again after their match ended in a draw. Portlaoise are the league champions for the 8th successive time, and the Nair saw of Stradbally in Waterford. One of the stories of the day came in Cork. Ballincollig won their first ever Cork title thanks to a 113-110 win against Carberry. They came from 7 points down at one stage to win it. A day to remember for John Miskela. He's been speaking to Pat McAuliffe.
It's fantastic for us, it's fantastic for the club. As you say now, it's 128 years we're in existence. We never got to a county final, senior county championship, and to get here today and win it is absolutely fantastic, especially after the start we got, you know.
18 years yourself playing senior football, you're 36 years of age. You did mention that this year has been the most enjoyable of all.
It has. I've had a couple of bad years, last couple of years with injury. I didn't think I'd be playing this year, to be honest, but I just came down a way of keeping fit more than anything, and I managed to get in the team and managed to play, so it's been fantastic, really.
You've been very modest, John, because you're not alone in the team, but you're the starring role out there today. What was it like to play in that county final?
Very intense, desperate start. We had a desperate start. We said all week that we were trying to get a good start. Don't let them get their heads up, and we had a bad start, but it was absolutely fantastic character. We had in the first round against the Bars, we had a bad start, and we came at them today. It was fantastic.
One of the oldest clubs in the country. About time.
28 years.
About time for them to win a senior title, wasn't it? I hope they enjoy it. In hurling, Shelmaliers and St. Anne's played out a draw, and the Wexford decider Kilcormac Laoghaire made it 3 in a row in Offaly. Kilmallock pulled off a surprise victory in the Limerick final. They beat Napiercig. Raharney are the Westmead champions. St. Mullins are the county champions in Carlow, while the Leitrim title went to St. Mary's. Kevin Phelan finished in third place at the Hong Kong Open at the weekend. And finally, Mikko Ilonen beat Henrik Stenson 3-1 to win the World Match Play event at the London Club in Kent.
Thank you very much, Darren. 8:45. For the first time, the US military has airdropped weapons, ammunition and medical supplies to Syrian Kurds in the besieged city of Kobane. Kobane has been under attack by Islamic State forces for more than a month now. Journalist Catherine James has just returned from the Syrian-Turkish border and she joins us from Istanbul. What's known about this drop?
Rachel, what we know so far is simply what the US Central Command released a statement yesterday saying that the airdrop had taken place. About 27 bundles, ammunition, small arms and medical supplies. So it's not what the Kurds in Kobani were calling for, which is larger weapons, heavy artillery that can combat the ISIS artillery. But it is something.
Now, Turkey has been reluctant to arm the Kurds or to intervene militarily. So how is this move likely to go down in Turkey?
It will be an interesting point because yesterday the Turkish president, Erdogan, did say that he would not allow Kurdish fighters to receive any arms, any transfer of arms. Now, they have been blocking the border into Kobani from the Turkish side. So there has been a lot of calls for Turkey to open the border and allow arms and or Kurdish fighters who want to go and help defend Kobani to go in. But Turkey has not allowed that. So it is going to be a difficult situation. The US is an ally of Turkey, and the US has gone in and done an airdrop, which is only small guns and ammunition, but it still is quite significant. And also keep in mind that this kind of decision taken regardless of what Erdogan's wishes are, it will be interesting to see what kind of diplomatic situation this involves. But Turkey as yet has not responded.
Catherine, thank you for joining us on the line. Journalist Catherine James there in Istanbul.
Simon Moroney was 16 when he died by suicide over 10 years ago. His family wanted to help others who might be at risk. They set up a voluntary group called Save Our Sons and Daughters, SOSAD, in their hometown of Drogheda. It now has branches across the northeast. Elaine Keogh reports.
We're in SOSAD in Drogheda in 30 Magdalen Street. What goes on here is we try to help anyone affected by suicide or depression, as well as those bereaved by suicide. How we work is we operate, we're on the phones 24 hours a day to help people who are in distress. The aim of the phone call is to try and help people or keep them safe from suicide for the shortest time. And as soon as possible then, we need to get them in with one of our psychologists for either a psychological assessment or a suicide risk assessment. We try our very best to get everybody into counselling within a week of the assessment. And the counselling then will go on as long as necessary with the client. And at the moment in Drogheda, there's 140 people getting counselling here this week. And in the charity, there's 350 people getting counselling.
So Sad opened its first branch in Drogheda in 2007. Now it is also in Navan, Dundalk, Cavan, Carrickmacross and Tullamore. All are run by volunteers and all opened in response to the needs of the local communities. Patrick was a client in Drogheda and says the support it offered him was crucial.
I think what makes it great is having that one-to-one contact, the face. There is no substitute for human contact. I know of other guys who weren't dealing with situations and seemed to be go happy fellas. And there was a stage when one guy killed himself. And I just went walking the streets. I just kept thinking, I might as well do the same. I was reminded of one thing one counsellor said. To treat yourself every day. Do something for yourself every day. You know, just to, even to buying a little bun down in McCluskey's or whatever it is. I don't know if those people had known that the services were easily available, such as SOSAD, that they might have stopped for that split second and just said, you know what, I'll ring that number now.
SOSAD estimates that 11% of its clients are children and teenagers, and Peter Moroney told me that for many of them, the issue is bullying.
And strangely enough, we have quite a number of them who are under 14 years of age, 15 years of age, who comes to us with various issues. They need specialist child therapy, and thankfully we have child therapists that we use, and we can refer to them. And again, no waiting list. See you straight away, getting straight away. But our youngest client at the moment is 8 years of age. Of the age group from 10 up, nearly every single one of them seems to be a result of bullying. It's this social networking site, it's bullying. It never stops. You can never get away from it. Turn on the phone, you're being bullied. Turn on the computer, you've been bullied. Turn on that, you're bullied. And I think that's a big problem for our under-17s, under-18s in this at the moment.
Peter says SOSAD has begun to see a shift and men are now starting to access services.
For once, we're starting to tackle the terrible stigma associated with suicide and mental health in general. And I think more people are willing to come forward and get the help they need. And for example, I hate this thing about men won't come forward. 46% of the people we've seen last year were male. And I think that's got to do with the confidentiality, we don't report to anybody, we're quiet in here, we're discreet, and I think men in particular are willing to come and get that help in here.
Since 2007, Peter says more than 8,000 people have used SOSAD services. However, he believes his son Simon remains the driving force behind what it does.
Family believe that all this happened because of Simon. And I believe that Simon's watching over us and guiding us, and he has us doing this work. Sometimes it's not easy and I could kick his ass, really. But sometimes it's there and we're here to help somebody. And I think he's driving us on, and it's his idea, it's his legacy. We're doing this for him.
That was Peter Moroney ending that report by Elaine Keogh. The National Office for Suicide Prevention launches a new campaign today called Little Things, which is focusing on the difference a little thing can make at difficult times. You can contact SOSAD at 041 984 8754. That's 041 984 8754. Catholic bishops have scrapped their landmark Welcome to Gays, showing deep divisions at the end of a two-week meeting sought by Pope Francis to chart a more merciful approach to ministering to Catholic families. The bishops failed to approve even a watered-down section on ministering to gays, which stripped away the welcoming tone contained in a draft document earlier in the week. Let's speak to Father Bernard Lynch. He's an openly gay Catholic priest who has led the change for liberalisation of the church. He's based in London. Father Lynch, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
What do you make of this apparent turnaround?
Well, I mean, I'm very disappointed, and at the same time, I'm not surprised. I was cheered by the fact that we were being discussed, although, I mean, I don't like the idea of other people talking about us. I mean, where were we at that synod? I mean, where were the openly gay bishops or priests? And maybe that may sound strange to some of your listeners. But as we know so well, there are many gay bishops and priests, and some of them are not in the best light. And, you know, if you're not a guest at the table, you're always on the menu. And I was very, very disappointed with the way this has ended up. It's not over until it's over. But, you know, we must realize that at rock bottom, the church teaching in relationship to us who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered is absolutely heinous. I mean, we are regarded by them from the top down as disordered in our nature. And those of us in loving, faithful, civil partnerships, marriages of longevity, these relationships, the teaching is when sexually expressed and what marriage does not sexually express itself, this is regarded as evil. Now, I couldn't think of a more evil teaching. And I was just listening into your last, and I don't want to piggyback on that. But, I mean, I know for a fact, as you know, I come from the west of Ireland, Ennis, County Clare. And I know for a fact that a lot of the suicides amongst young people, that the Catholic Church's teaching on gays is conduit, as former President McAleese said, to a lot of these suicides. And I'm chair of the Committee on Lesbian Gay People here in Camden Town, where I live in London. And the same is true. The bullying of young people in schools because they happen to be created by God in his gay image and likeness. And the churches are not only not a help, they are part of this evil. And the fact that the Pope, a good man,
yes,
this Pope, couldn't, you know, change that in the minds of his bishop. I mean, where is Christ in all of this? Isn't it supposed to be about Jesus Christ?
Father Lynch,
very simple.
I gather you don't officially officiate anymore as a priest. You described yourself once as being like a doctor without a license. Why would you want to be part of a church that perceives the homosexual community as being disordered?
A very good question, and most of my contemporaries, you know, who worked with me in the AIDS crisis in New York, have left completely. They would have nothing to do with it. And, of course, 94%, I think, of young people who are sexually different will have nothing to do with the Catholic Church. But I think I've given you the answer. These people have so much power over people. They're still the news headline.
Okay.
You know, and I don't stay because of the goodness of the church towards me and my kind. There is no way. I mean, as Sister Patrice Murphy, who worked with me in New York, said, you have to transcend the Catholic Church if you want any relationship with God and Christ and your good self.
Father Bernard Lynch, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. It's a minute to nine.